first time I got to blow my father a kiss, and he pretended to catch it. I must remember this, I thought. I turned the corner, past the last window I could see him through. As soon as he was out of my line of sight, I panicked. I ran back to the glass window, still crying. He was in the seat, smiling, waiting for me. I mouthed, "I love you." He laughed, and I wished I could hear it just one more time. He mouthed, "I love you too. Now go." I waved one last time and rounded the corner. I got 3 hours to tell the person I loved who I was. Now I had to gather my quarters and head back to my life, separate from him. It felt wrong to walk out of that ugly building without my father. I wanted to be taking him away from there. It felt wrong not to be holding his hand and heading home together. I was in no position to pardon him for the crimes he hadn't committed against me, and I didn't want to be. I could not forgive him in place of those he had harmed. I wept all the way to Trent's car. He was breaking the law and waiting there for me, sleeping and unafraid of being caught. I opened the passenger door and he stirred awake. "How did it go?" I opened my mouth to answer, and instead, I dissolved. In the visiting room, there was no space to break down, to melt with emotion. Sitting across from my father for the first time in 13 years, both of us swollen with all the things we needed to say to one another, the thought of letting all of this feeling overtake me seemed wasteful, inefficient. In those moments, I needed more from myself, restraint. But now, I was in a car with one of my closest friends. The visit was over. Every little thing I couldn't allow myself to feel in my father's presence made itself known. Trent rubbed my back. "What can I do?" After I caught my breath, I answered, "A drink. I need a drink." Trent laughed and mentioned that he'd spotted a winery on our way there. "We should pop in and see if we could do a tasting." I agreed. As we pulled off, Trent asked, "Did you get what you needed?" I rolled down the window again and closed my eyes. "Yes, I think I did." "How does that feel?" I smiled to myself. My father's permission to keep writing felt like a secret I wasn't ready to tell. I leaned farther out the window. I could hear the wind zipping past the planes of my face, still tight and sticky with tears I hadn't bothered to wipe away. The sunshine turned the inside of my eyelids pink and purple. Inside of myself, I let go. I did not worry about what I hadn't been able to share or the life I was returning to. For half a minute, I was flying. For half a minute, I knew I had it in me to tell the truth and be loved anyway. Chapter 29. After visiting my father, I never really shifted into my senior year. The cost was too much, and I couldn't sustain the scramble to make ends meet while affording tuition at the same time. I stayed in Muncie, taking a class at a time to cut costs and lingering in spaces generally reserved for students. I met a few friends at a bar called Savages downtown. The $2 beers there were enough to get me tipsy without making me feel bad for buying good drinks I couldn't ever finish. I found my friends in the winterized sunroom section and sat down to shoot the shit or wait to shoot pool. Somehow, the subject of the locals came up, and we started to question at what point someone who lives here but never seems to graduate or stop taking classes officially becomes a townie. Townies was a term I'd seen used to start fights and describe the nicest guy in the room. But even people who used it in a non-pejorative sense didn't want to be called one. I realized I was closing in on all the criteria. One of the guys leaned toward me and said, "You're going to be like the Kim Kardashian of Muncie." He laughed, but I didn't. The first thing I did when I walked into my bedroom that night was write on the chalkboard wall beside my desk, "Get out of here as fast as you can." Muncie hadn't been all bad to me by any means. I'd found close friends who felt like family, a real passion for writing, and a creative community who supported my work and often just me. The father of the boys I'd babysat, Mitch, and his wife, Becky, were two of them. "I think you're done with this place, kiddo." He'd stopped me for a hug in the front yard, and just when I thought he was going to let go, he held me tighter and said, "No matter where you go, this home will be yours." I cried openly while walking to my car. It hurt, wanting him to be right. Fort Wayne was the most reasonable option to move. I even had an offer to stay with a friend from high school, rent-free, while her husband was deployed. It would mean being able to attend my little brother's football games and my sister's track meets at the local college. I knew more people there than anywhere else in the world. My mother's and my relationship was still rocky, but I constantly worried I wasn't spending enough time with my family. I was also afraid to go back and live there again. I was different, and not everybody was going to be able to handle that, and I didn't trust myself to handle them. I found myself looking for a way out. And when an old friend called and asked if I'd like to move into his third bedroom in Indianapolis, I said, "Yes, hold it for me. I'll be there." Like every move before, I quickly decided what could fit into my car and what couldn't. Everything that didn't fit would have to be given away, thrown away, or abandoned. No one was going to pull up with a U-Haul or a larger vehicle and help me. And I didn't think to ask for help. I stuffed my Ford Taurus to the gills and hit I-69 for Indianapolis, leaving behind a few precious things, trying to forget them along the way. To make rent, buy gas, and eat food, I worked two jobs, one as an after-school tutor for children in Indianapolis homeless shelters, and another down the road as a part-time receptionist in the administrative office of a church. I was also getting small freelance assignments from a local copywriting agency. It was easy, boring, and it paid. Copywriting in my cold, sun-drenched bedroom didn't require the patience of wrangling small, chronically neglected children, nor the fortitude to listen to a mid-50s divorcee go on a rant about her ex-husband. None of it was particularly rewarding. Half of my tutoring groups were made up of children who read at or exceeded their grade level, and in the other half, I was teaching 7-year-olds the alphabet. I couldn't help any of them as much as I wanted to, and spending time around people who work on the business side of church, yes, there's a business side, was a great way to remember why church never made sense to me, even when I begged God to make it so. After a couple months of working nonstop, I still didn't have anything close to the amount of money I would need to finish my last college requirements. When I froze and allowed myself to consider it may all have been for nothing, that I was never going to reach the heights that were expected of me, the ensuing panic shook me loose from my numbing place and pushed me towards something new. That anxious kickstart always came when I was most in need of assistance, but it was becoming harder and harder to access. The panic that used to help me jump up and finish a paper overnight could only be activated by something as dire as meeting a basic need. Even then, at times, my motivation couldn't break through. I needed something else. Shuffling through a lackluster and inconsistent morning routine, I was late to every job I had except copywriting. I knew I'd get in trouble and apologized profusely to my superiors when called on it, but I didn't stop. I couldn't convince myself that my presence mattered, and so found it harder and harder to show up. Sometimes, speeding down Central Avenue on my way to work, I'd remind myself that I couldn't fuck this up. I didn't have anything or anyone to fall back on. If I got fired, I was on my own. Or worse, I'd have to go backward. "Is that what you want?" I asked myself, knowing the answer. No, I didn't want to go back. Not to any of the places I'd already been. Then why did I keep missing meetings, losing paperwork, and being late? When I asked myself, "What if you fail?" my brain answered, "Isn't that what you're already doing?" I felt it wasn't true, but I couldn't find the arguments to defend myself. Maybe you can't find them because they aren't there. Maybe that was true. I didn't want it to be. It felt wrong. And yet. My grandmother's comforting laugh came through the phone when I called to complain. It made me miss her, her warm house, and every delicious meal she'd ever made just for me. When she asked how I'd been doing, I told her I was on the verge of being fired. "Well," she said, "you know you can all..." "Don't," I said. She huffed like I had my nerve. And it was true. I did. It was never my intention to hurt or frustrate my grandmother. But it felt so important she know, that all my family know, I was not coming back because I was not the same person. And I could not, would not, pretend. Really, it was for their own good. I complicated the narrative they wanted to live by, and it didn't bother me until it bothered them. I didn't want to run from my family. I wanted to be who I was, and I didn't know if that person fit among them anymore. I was afraid to find out that I wouldn't. My lessons hadn't always come the way I wanted or hoped, but I was not ashamed of how I had changed, and I was determined to remember that. Sometimes, when I was with my family, I forgot. "You need to go to the library," my grandmother offered. "Remember when you spent so much time at the one up here?" The library's front door was across the road from mine, and I dutifully followed my grandmother's instructions. I hadn't lived this close to a library since I was a child, and I checked out book after book. I got weird looks from the white librarians as I pulled different books from the shelves. The librarians I'd grown up around had been white too, but they hadn't seemed afraid of me or anyone else. I suppose I was a child then, not a woman who spent 3 hours in their facility in the middle of the day, book browsing, wandering through the aisles, and touching the spines as I read them for titles, authors, and interest. It didn't matter that I knew I loved these volumes now the same way I did then, because the people who looked at me didn't think I looked like that might be true. Truthfully, I'd been reading for school or to keep up with conversation for a long time. It felt good to read toward answers to the questions in my head, a familiar source of solace I hadn't tapped in too long. It made me miss home, even though I didn't want to be there. I started to miss my father, who wrote to me about the books he was reading. I never wrote back. I still didn't know what to say or how to confront what he'd done, but I found him in the pages I skimmed through. I'd pushed down the thought of him for such a long while, but he was always there in the background. A nagging thought, demanding my attention, telling me how good and smart I might be, more so than I realized, and how much more I might be worthy of, like a better story. Chapter 30. It wasn't lost on me that I mostly spoke my truth in the spaces where my family was absent. Still, the words for an essay about what had happened to me in the shed, about discovering why my dad was in prison and how it made me feel, poured out. There was small comfort in knowing my mother could barely use email, let alone browse the internet for my writing. I planned to post the essay to a blog I shared with some writer friends from college having no idea the response it would get. Still, I knew I should tell her. When the essay went up, my mother would know what had happened to me in her backyard, and that I hadn't come to her like I promised I would. It rained all day, but when I went out on our front porch just after dark, the rain had stopped. The wet asphalt shimmered under the streetlights like it was covered in broken glass. I called my mother to confess. We greeted each other, and she told me about a recent football game of my baby brother's. It astounded me how much she knew about the game, how closely she followed his stats, and her commitment to being in the stands almost every time he played, even away games. The youngest was giving her the chance to mother the way she wanted, and in some ways, it made her vulnerable. I stepped off the porch and paced on the sidewalk in front of the apartment. "Mom," I said, "I'm writing an essay, and there's something in it I want you to know before you read it." My words sucked every bit of mirth out of the atmosphere between us. "What?" She said it hard, flat, less like a question and more like a demand. I remembered that I was not my little brother, and their dynamic had nothing to do with me. But I still had something to say. "I was raped," I said it, and left it there. "It was Bradley, wasn't it?" She said it like she'd been there in the shed with me, like she'd already known. "I understand why you didn't tell me." I stopped pacing and held my breath. I didn't know what to say, and I was scared to say more. My mother spoke instead. "I was crazy back then." The essay went up, and then it was republished in a literary magazine, and people wrote to me from all over about my work, my writing. The piece landed me a job as an administrative assistant at a small company in Indianapolis, and my life miraculously began to stabilize. When bill collectors called regarding past due medical and credit card bills, I was able to offer them some form of payment or take on payment plans, knowing I would actually be able to meet the obligations. When my friends wanted to go out to celebrate a birthday or meet up at a bar for no reason at all, I now had enough money to cover my own meal, drink, and add to the tip. I signed up for health insurance, and twice a week, I took myself out for dinner. On Sundays, I bought flowers and arranged them on the coffee table. I looked at them and thought about my father and how his hands had held mine while he emphatically told me to write our story. I thought about how beautiful living things, cut off from their joy, eventually wither and die. Then I pushed that thought from my mind. For me, this was the dream. A stable, full-time, non-demanding position that paid enough to afford a small life and still allowed me to write on the side. It's what I was working toward those last 2 years of college and what I'd come to Indianapolis to find. A writer friend named Isaac had even offered to link me up with people looking for writers in New York City, which sounded like another world. I didn't really believe him, but the offer made me feel good. I knew I was lucky to have so many people rooting for me, good people and writers who were on my side, but sometimes my feelings of unworthiness crept in. A part of me was ashamed that I'd gotten my version of it all and felt compelled to smash it under my heel. During my lunch breaks at work, I would walk around the neighborhood just behind the main drag. Just as I had as a child, I made up stories about the people who must live in those houses and tried to ignore the gathering anxiety in the center of my chest. It made me angry. I didn't want to be sad. I didn't want to be anxious. I didn't want to want anything more than I had. Enough. I tried to settle my spirit on my own. What more could you need? Will any of it be enough? I waited for my nerves to trip the numbing wire, but the warm nothing never came. I started to panic on the sidewalk, anxiously looking around me, not for help, but to make sure no one was watching this happen. The sweat forming in the palms of my hands loosened my grip on my phone, reminding me it was there. I could call someone. My fingers started moving, and soon I heard my mother's voice. "Hello, daughter." I could tell she was suppressing a smile, pleased that I had called her. "Hello, mother," I responded, matching her tone. Then I started crying. And for a whole minute, I didn't stop. When I spoke again, I told my mother I was sorry for crying, but I just didn't feel happy, and I didn't know what to do. "It's a great job, Mama. I don't know. I just feel like I'm supposed to be doing something else, even though I should feel grateful for this." "What makes you happy?" I stopped walking. Had she ever asked me that before? I assumed the only time my mother had ever missed me was after I'd moved out of her house, and even that took a whole year. Somewhere along the way, somewhere in all that time of hasty, inconsistent phone calls and one-way visits, my mother started to warm to me. Our conversations became easier, and I found a deep and resounding comfort in having the choice to walk away when they went to places I didn't want them to go, or didn't trust myself to come back from. But now, I didn't want to walk away. I wanted to give her a true answer. I like making things. Art, stories. I want to write. I wondered if she knew, when I said I wanted to write, that I meant I wanted to write about me, about us, about everything I saw and believed and thought I might know. She let out a breath. "Ashley, you're the only person who has to live in your skin and wake up with the consequences of your choices. That's why you can't let other people make the big choices for you. You have to do what it feels right to do, and you can't let anybody stop you." I heard the stifled smile again. "Not even me." Isaac hadn't been kidding when he said he wanted to connect me with a few editors at the media company where he worked. Within a month, I'd gotten emails from and pitched two of them. Both pitches were accepted, and the first called for me to mention my history with sexual harassment and assault. It didn't mention my father's story, but my own, and the aftermath of knowing the reality of violation in your body and keeping it there so nobody else could see it. I wanted to write about it. I used to buckle under the shame of what had happened to me in that shed, but my anger outweighed my sadness the more I talked and wrote about what happened. Everything moved at a pace I wasn't accustomed to, and I welcomed it. Within 3 months, I was accepted into a writer's residency, rekindled an old flame from college, and got offered a full-time writing position for a growing media publication in Manhattan. Kelly and I started seeing each other casually toward the end of our time at Ball State, but he wasn't meant to be a romantic love, or at least, I didn't mean for him to be. He was 3 years younger than me, the kind of party boy I found it hard to keep up with, and he was leaving at the end of the semester for an internship in New York City. When his internship ended, he came back to Indiana for a bit, then landed in Seattle. He kept calling me. One day he called me to say he was in Indianapolis and wanted to see me. About 1 week later, we decided he was my boyfriend, and he returned to Seattle. I was certain he'd break up with me upon learning I'd accepted a job that would keep us even farther apart, but he sighed and said, "I guess I'll meet you in the city." Before I moved, I drove up to Fort Wayne to see friends and family, part of a pre-move farewell tour. When I called my mother to tell her I was coming, she mentioned that my grandmother had not been feeling well and had been admitted to the hospital. Her tone of voice, higher and lighter than usual, didn't inspire the confidence she obviously intended. My stomach sank to my feet at a snail's pace and landed just as I crossed the city limits. My grandmother was sleeping when I walked into her hospital room, an old friend dozing in the chair next to her bed. When I softly said hello to them both, my grandmother's friend rose with a start, snorted, and began her goodbye before she was on her feet. She reached out to me for a hug, then leaned over my grandmother for a farewell air kiss. She didn't really like to be touched in the best of times, and this woman knew her well enough to know she'd like it even less now. I panicked at the thought of being alone with my grandmother, something I'd never felt before, and assured her small, slow-moving friend she was welcome to stay. "No thank you, baby," she demurred. "I already slept through half of my next visit." She picked up her open Bible from the table beside her and said goodbye again. Then she stopped, turned back to the bed, and reached out to hold my grandmother. The hug they shared lasted long enough to make me think I was right to hesitate. My grandmother didn't hold people. She didn't lean into anyone's arms. I'd never seen my grandmother be held. And so, I suspected, almost immediately, I would not have long to ever see it again. After she left, I turned to take the friend's seat. The chair was still warm from her slumbering body. I sank in and soaked it up. My hands were already beginning to tremble. My grandmother and I caught up for about 5 minutes before going silent. I stared at her and she stared at the television set near the foot of her bed. In a moment, she picked up the remote control to change the channel, clicking towards something in black and white, something with a little more dust. I assumed she was looking for what felt most like home to her and less like the room we currently shared. She settled on an old favorite, Bonanza. She didn't turn her eyes away from it when she said, "It's cancer." I covered her hand with mine. I felt the cold steel of the hospital bar beneath my fingers and her palm. My stomach churned with fear and my torso threatened to fold over into the familiar ball I became when I thought my feelings could shoot from the soft core of my body, exploding from intensity and destroying me from the inside out. The tears I felt coming stopped just before springing from their hiding places. My mind raced with anxious thoughts, sadness, and then resolve. She turned her head toward me at half speed. She looked into my eyes and said, "I don't want to do chemotherapy." I leaned close enough for my grandmother, my dearest love, to hear the smile I couldn't bring to my face. "Then you don't have to." Billy Coles was going to die. Like everything else she had ever done or said, it would be done her way. After all she had given me, despite whatever cruelties had snuck in along the way, I owed her my willingness to walk beside her during this time. I would hold her hand. "I think I'll stay in Indiana a little longer." I said it before I thought it. I couldn't say why. I knew I didn't want to stay in Indiana or tell the people in New York City I would no longer be coming. The dream I'd worked toward was so many miles away, and nothing inside me wanted to give it up. But this was my grandmother. Hadn't she held and protected me when no one else had? Taken me away to the farm, let me choose my own movies, and bought me a toy every single Saturday for almost a year? Hadn't she doted on me and made me feel loved? All that she'd ever really asked for was my company and willingness to listen. This was the best I had to offer. My dreams in exchange for a debt owed. My grandmother turned to me with flared nostrils. "Hell no, you won't. Just call." Her gaze returned to the television. I was both relieved and disgusted at myself for the heft of my relief. I would call. I would check on her. I would defend her and her decisions until her last breath. As I sighed and relaxed my already rising shoulders, I began to count her breaths. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I counted and I wondered, despite the thought's morbidity, how many inhales and exhales she had left to go. We sat like that, in silent agreement about our roles moving forward, for another hour. Before I left, I bent down and kissed my grandmother's cheek. Her skin was soft like the brushed underside of a leather belt. She smelled like powder and musk and sweat, but somehow not at all like the hospital. I took a deep breath, hoping to keep the scent with me as I left the room. 2 weeks later, I walked into the Indianapolis airport with all my belongings packed into 2 bags. I headed straight for security. The TSA agent looked at my driver's license and asked how long I would be visiting New York. I looked at him with determination, responding that I was not a visitor. I was a future resident. He scanned my face, then looked me up and down skeptically. "Okay, how long will you be staying in New York?" I stood up as tall as my body would let me. "As long as they want me." It was the kind of thing you can only get away with saying in the Midwest, so I said it before I was gone too far away. My flight went smoothly, and Brett met me at LaGuardia. He carried my bags into the taxi line, then helped the driver get them into the trunk. He'd moved to New York to give Broadway his best shot almost 6 months before I arrived. When I told him I was coming, he squealed and insisted he'd meet me. He didn't allow me to argue. He wasn't new. It had been a long time since we last saw each other, and he was involved with someone now. I was happy for him. It took time, but we'd learned how to have one another without a romantic element. He helped me into the back of the taxi, slid into the seat next to mine, and gave the driver directions to Isaac's apartment, where I would be staying for 2 weeks. He kissed my cheek and fell asleep on my shoulder. After Brett helped me pull my 2 duffel bags into Isaac's apartment, he bid me farewell and made his way back to Washington Heights. I sank into a yellow armchair and closed my eyes. My phone rang. It was my mother. I smiled at her calling, checking up on me, and felt a little embarrassed at the inner flit of glee. It seemed so normal. I answered the call. "Hello, Mother," I said. She didn't greet me back in our usual way, so I sat up a little. "I have a question," she said. "Of course, you can ask me a question." I heard her stop moving on the other end. This was starting to feel more like an interrogation than a check-in. She finally spoke. "Why can't you ever write about the happy times we had? We had happy times, too." I closed my eyes, let my head fall back onto the chair, and suppressed a smile, even though there was no one else around to see it. Chapter 31. I wasn't in New York long before my sister called to tell me our grandmother was in the hospital again. I told her I'd be home as soon as I could. After we hung up, I realized I couldn't actually afford the airfare. I'd moved out of Isaac's apartment and in with Kelly. We were paying 2/3 of the monthly rent to live in the smaller room of a 2-bedroom apartment. He'd just started working through a temp agency, but his first check hadn't come in yet, and even when it did, we would need it, all of it, just to keep our bills paid. Eventually, a generous mentor and friend offered to pay for my flight home. Where I would usually put up a fight, feeling unworthy of such an act of care, I humbly accepted. For my grandmother, even at her worst, I would have asked each person I met for a dollar until I had every cent I needed to say goodbye. Pulling into the visitor's parking lot, I remembered how hospitals made me feel. The hallways were stark and busy. All the white, the quick tapping and furtive small movements reminded me of too many mice in a maze. Everything that happened here felt secretive, as if sickness and death were, or should be, a person's greatest shame. Things moved quickly and deliberately, but you were just supposed to pretend none of it was happening. Just don't look. Just smile at the nurse through your tears. Just visit the gift shop. Just grab a coffee in the cafeteria. Just forget this feeling and decide to be somewhere else in your mind, especially if that place doesn't include sickness, injury, disability, or death. If you have to be here, be somewhere else too. I was familiar with those rules, but had run away from them a long time ago. I was out of practice. Instead of writing down my grandmother's room number, I'd memorized it. I didn't trust myself not to lose a piece of paper or to find a note I'd made in my phone. This was a moment where I'd have to trust my ability to make a memory and keep it. For her, I could do this. When I walked up to the nurse's station and asked to see Billy Coles in room blank, the nurse gave me a sad smile before pointing toward a plain brown door and telling me where I would need to turn right or left. I rushed past a visitor's lounge where members of my family sat playing with a few cousins, nieces, and nephews. Everyone was here, but my body compelled me to go only in the direction the nurse had told me to, lest I lose the memory and so lose my way. My back was straight, and I knew every step toward her room could be the step when I began to hear the cries that would tell me I was too late. My anxiety propelled me forward. Standing still was not an option. When I found the door to my grandmother's hospital room, I whipped back toward the visitor's lounge, suddenly needing a moment to think before I saw her. Knowing my grandmother, it would be worse to show up in time and say the wrong thing than to be 10 steps too late to say anything at all. My family members greeted me with tired smiles and big hugs. The children ignored or studied me. This is what happens when you move away from home, I thought. Your young family might never know who you are. I had been raised the way they were being raised now, and so I knew how it felt to have someone from out of town call themselves your family and to be stunned at the notion that family could be more than a 20-minute drive away. I sat in the lounge for a few minutes, catching up those who wanted to know what I'd been up to since moving away. I gave them the highlights. Still working at the media company, still working on the book, Kel and I had moved in together. I did not give them the lowlights. I'm broke. I'm sad a lot. I don't like my dream job anymore. Grandma is going to die, and I don't know what to do. We all got quiet for a bit, mentally retreating back into our own most comfortable thoughts. I continued to sit with my family, looking around at all their faces, some I hadn't seen in years. For so long, I'd resented them. I felt they tethered me to that girl I didn't want to be anymore, and so I'd left. First to college, then to Indianapolis, and now New York. I felt more secure in myself than ever, certainly more than I'd felt under my mother's roof, but I still needed them. They were part of me, whether I acknowledged it or not. My mother was adamant that all we had and all we'd ever need was family. If she was right, I had everything I needed. My mother, her four sisters, all of their children, and my grandmother lived in the same neighborhood. My cousins and I were raised like siblings who lived in different houses. My family had been around so much, they became hard to escape. I dreamed of aunts and uncles who lived in other states or even other countries that I could visit in the summertime. Supposedly, everything I needed in the world was always a short walk from my room. Even then, I felt guilty about wanting more. My cousins and I constantly joke about my grandmother's attempts to keep me close to home. "Ashley, why would you go away to school? Don't you know people get killed on college campuses every day? Did you know New York has 10 rats for every person who lives there? You want to live like that? You can always come home." My grandma was everything to me, but my fear of staying put would not be tempered. There have been losses in the decision to leave home. When my sister's father died, I could not hold her. When my cousins have babies, I am not there to visit them in the hospital. My grandmother was dying, and I was not there to sit with her and write down every hilarious and magical thing she said. I wasn't there to remember it all, every detail, for her, and for me too. But I was the only one who could figure out how to get my sister to her father's funeral. When I come home, my cousins get a break from their babies because I can't stop holding them. And when my grandmother needed someone to take over a bill or two, I was able to make that happen for her. Still, the feeling that I was failing them with the lack of physical presence never went away. If family was everything, the source of all that was needed to complete the picture, I was a willfully missing piece of the puzzle. And though I loved these people, I knew this was not my home anymore. I sat in the waiting room feeling like a coward. What exactly was I afraid would happen to me when I saw her? That was the hard part. I didn't know. There was a convincing portion of my ability to reason that was resigned to the fact that indeed my grandmother's death might kill me. Yes, I had known pain. But greater than this? I didn't think so. Every terrible thing that had ever happened to me, I would re-experience in real time if it gave my grandmother more time in this life. I stood up, offered another round of hugs. A small mirror hung above the light switch in the doorway. I stopped there to reapply my lipstick. I pressed my lips together and smiled to check for coverage. I used my fingers to separate the natural hair around my crown, knowing my grandmother won't like it, but wanting to feel like I looked nice. Just for me. Her room was filled with more members of my family. My mother, brothers, sister, and a smattering of cousins formed a sloppy half circle around my grandmother's bed. The fluorescent lights gave each of them a thin gray mask, and before my eyes, my family became a room of nervous mourning ghosts. They sat uncomfortably on the hyperfunctional and mostly taupe furniture. The adequately padded chairs invited you to sit, but the cold steel bars protruding beneath the pads warned, "Don't stay too long." Each person looked as if they'd rather be anywhere else. A room full of people bonded by blood and fear, and though I felt apart from them for the first time in a long while, I did not feel alone. The first person I saw and hugged was my mother. It was the right thing to do and would have been noted if I hadn't done it. Then my sister walked over to me with open arms, and I opened mine to her as well. RC threw me a smile from the other side of the room, and I tentatively smiled back, lamenting the wane in our closeness. I loved him then, as I always had, but we didn't know how to talk to each other anymore. I sensed a depth of pain in my brother I would not be allowed to explore or attempt to remedy. I wasn't sure how much it had to do with me, but I knew the healing process wasn't mine to lead. If I'd learned anything being on my own these last few years, it was how much I needed this time away from my family to see myself clearly. My grandmother lay in the bed, mouth agape, about 50 pounds lighter than she'd been at Christmas, and wigless. For as long as I'd been alive, she hadn't left the house without a hairpiece of some kind, covering or clipped to her own short, curly hair. I stood immobile, startled by the fragile human that lay before me. She was my grandmother, and yet she was not. She was also a catfish, small and still, gills gasping, finding little to no respite, and trying anyway. I moved over to her, trying to find a good spot among all the wires and humming medical devices. My lips connected with her cheek, and where they sunk into a firm softness only months ago, they now hit the steel of her cheekbone far too soon. She was alive, her labored breath a beating reminder, but the warmth was already slipping from the air hovering 5 inches above her shell. I did not shiver or recoil in the presence of her impending death, and I was proud of myself for not ruining the moment with my feelings. Her eyes fluttered, then opened wide. It took a moment to recognize me, but once she did, the corners of her mouth lifted slightly. She knew I was there. "Hi, Grandma." I smiled at her with as much sincerity as I could muster. This was not a smiling time, and I did not want to lie with my face, but this wasn't about me. Her eyes slipped a little farther back, and then she was confused. She screwed up her face a bit and assessed me from the corner of her eyes before saying, "Quit being so weird." I turned to my sister and made a face. There she was. My sister's raised eyebrows and tilted head replied, "Same old grandma." These were the moments we'd recount over family dinners and gatherings years after her passing. After we'd all filled our bellies with various food and drink, shared a few jokes, and maybe even danced to an old familiar song turned up loud, someone would say, "Remember when Grandma used to?" And the rest of us would nod and laugh in recognition. We'd heard and shared these stories a million times before. There was always a story about Grandma. And everybody wanted to have the best story about some hilarious interaction with her. As I'd spent the most time with her, I usually had the best ones and could confirm the details of everyone else's. For years, I'd kept a mental log of all our adventures, and I was determined to own the last of them as well. In a way, it was comforting to have my grandmother be a little sharp with me from her deathbed. I always thought it was her sharpness that would keep her around. Who could die with that kind of fire coursing through their veins? But whatever burns will also burn up. Maybe it never made sense for anybody to run that hot for so long. Maybe, in her own way, she decided to drop that torch and let the light fade. Maybe she was ready to go, even if I wasn't ready for her to be gone. My grandmother had been the matriarch of my family in every sense of the word. My siblings, cousins, aunts, and even family friends joked that she was the real version of Tyler Perry's Medea caricature. Not because she carried a gun or spoke in an overemphasized accent, but because she kept us all together with hard language, good food, and stories of violence made into stomach-cramping laughs. My mother, her four sisters, and even us kids could get into fights with one another whenever and however we wanted. We could yell and scream, punch and kick, and even drip bitter thoughts into phone lines crackling with rage, historic or newly discovered. We could curse one another and swear to never again be in one another's presence. Then my grandmother would have a family dinner. Where there was once tension, there would be full bellies and reluctant laughter. There would be music and somewhere for the children to go play on their own. If there was persistent arguing, my grandmother could and often did put a stop to it, reminding us that some things families just don't say to one another. Her love wasn't perfect, but she was nobody's caricature. There was no one on the planet like her. My father wouldn't get to say goodbye to her, and the realization broke me down. He would never get to giggle with her about the boa constrictor she kept and how much it scared him to find it roaming the house at night, broken free from its cage and on the hunt. He would never get to apologize to her face for leaving her daughter alone with two children. He'd never get to explain to her that no, he hadn't been possessed by a demon. He'd committed a horrific crime, and he'd paid for it with significant portions of all our lives, and that even that might not be payment enough. He couldn't be here for her, or me, or himself, and I wanted to scream. As I turned away from my grandmother, a whole world in a dying body, my sister met me at the end of the hospital bed. We hugged again, and her own soft natural hair brushed against my face, smelling like synthetic flowers and slow warming sugar. Her arms, smaller than mine, held me tighter than I'd ever known her to hold anything or anyone. It was a moment, and it was a prayer. "Are you all right?" I asked. I looked into her eyes, ready to find an answer there if she chose not to verbally provide one. Just then, my grandmother opened her eyes and stared at us, both standing at the end of her bed. My sister and I turned to her. "Are you okay, Grandma? Do you need something?" Her eyes widened, and she stayed that way, silent and staring for several seconds. I stayed quiet. If there was ever a time to make a memory, that time was now. And if I made this memory for myself, and this was the last time I saw her alive, and she saw me, what would I want her to see? I would want her to see me. All of me. Even the parts she would hate. Just to give her the chance to see the full breadth of who I really was, and maybe, just for a moment, a real idea of who I might become. "You're gonna miss it," I thought. "I'm going to be so much better than I am now, and you're not going to be here to see it." My grandmother opened and closed her mouth, and the sound of her lips, dry from the work of breathing while dying, scraped like the meeting sides of a wrinkled brown paper bag. My mother leaned over and grabbed the cup filled with water, ice, and a white stick with a small square of green sponge stuck to the end. She soaked the sponge in and around the ice cubes, then lifted it to my grandmother's waiting mouth. Almost all of the water dissolved as the sponge met her papery lips, and the few drops that weren't immediately absorbed rolled back onto her equally parched tongue. My mother did this, back and forth, swirling, lifting, and soothing her mother. Her face was soft and ravaged. When she finally could, my grandmother spoke to me and my sister, still waiting at her feet. "Your hair," she started. My sister and I leaned in toward her at the same time. My grandmother's eyes began to water with frustration. "Your hair is so beautiful." We looked at one another, shocked. She'd always disliked my hair and my choice to go natural. She'd warned me that it would keep me from getting hired, keep me from finding a partner in life, and now, in the midst of her ultimate demise, she wanted me to know that actually, she loved my hair, as big and nappy and misshapen as it was. I turned to my mother and asked her who was spending the night in the room that evening, after all other visitors would be asked to leave. She looked at me and said, "You should." I agreed. After hugging everyone goodbye, I turned the taupe love seat into a bed for myself. I couldn't remember the last time my grandmother and I had slept in the same room, but I could remember many times before, from the beginning. I remembered falling asleep on her couch in the triplex, the warmth and scent of it as familiar as anything I'd ever known. I remembered sleeping in the same bed with her in Missouri, being read to from the Bible each night, then falling asleep to the sounds of MASH. I remembered falling asleep in her lap during long bus rides, slumbering against her body at a New Year's Eve church revival, and sometimes just lying there, listening to her snore, wondering what could be wrong with a person's nose and throat to make that kind of sound. This night in the hospital, our last together, I hardly slept at all. Each time she moved, moaned, or my mind convinced me she needed me, I rose and reached for the cup, the sponge, and then told my grandmother how much I loved her while trying to comfort her into a final rest. My mother found me the next morning. I couldn't remember any other time in our lives where we cried so openly in front of one another. But on this day, for this woman we loved, we bawled without shame or restraint. The shared act felt ancient, abundant, but it was unfamiliar. I stood in front of my mother, wanting to tell her that we didn't have time, that the time to be close was now. But all I could say was, "I'm not ready. Mama, I'm not ready." My mother surrounded me with her arms and used the full force of them to shield me from the whole rest of the world. "You are ready," she said. "You have to be, and you are." Up until my grandmother died, I'd just accepted the way things were, resigned to my role as the member of my family no one quite understood. It had been enough, maybe even part of the fuel that kept me going in the warped way these things do sometimes. But now, I wanted more. I wanted their closeness. I wanted to start over and let them see me as I am. I wanted to trust them. I wanted us to be as we are, people who love each other. I had a life and a home in New York with Kelly, but in so many ways, I'd abandoned my home here in Indiana. It didn't have to be this way. However complicated, I could exist in both as me, fully me. I could be strong enough because I had to be, if I didn't want to lose this. And I knew I didn't. Chapter 32. Kel and I were coming up on our first Christmas in our own space when my mother rang. Her voice sounded almost like my grandmother's as she said through the phone line, "You can always come home." Our apartment was decorated for the holidays, and I wanted to start new traditions, make memories, and finally get started on a life that felt like it was mine. But when my mother told me my father was getting out of prison, I knew it was time to go home. I knew now that moving forward required going back. I flew to Indiana and stayed for a week. I wanted to be there as soon as my father got home. So I arrived at my aunt's house early. I'd begged my mother to come with me, and she had been so startled by the request that she'd obliged. When I asked, I hadn't thought about the fact that my mother hadn't seen my father in person for 25 years. Did she want to see him? I didn't know, but I knew I needed her with me. I'd spent a lot of time teaching myself not to need anyone. Especially not my mother. But now, I didn't care. I wanted her there. She sat beside me, fidgeting nervously, but determined to be there the way I needed her to be. My heart burst with gratitude for her strength and the love that kept her glued to her seat when I'm sure she would have rather been anywhere else. As we waited, I realized this would be the first time I saw my parents in the same room. I'd heard them speak to one another on the phone a few times. I'd even read letters from him to her, ones clearly hidden or tucked away for safekeeping. My father always spoke of the great love he had for my mother, and my mother never spoke a word against him. Still, there was always pain bleeding into the space between them. He had betrayed her, betrayed us all, and his return didn't absolve him. We would all have so much to say to each other, so much to explain and release before we could have real or meaningful connections. Today was just the beginning. My mother, aunt, uncle, and I sat around talking for over an hour before we heard the garage door open. I stood up. He didn't know I was there. He didn't even know I was coming to see him. There was no reason for me to stand, but I did. I wanted to be the first person he saw, and I was. He walked over to me silently, put his arms around me, and kissed my temple. My aunt, composed and quiet seconds before, began to cry and yell, "Thank you, Father God! Thank you, Jesus!" My Uncle Clarence pulled out his phone and took dozens of photos. I could feel the buzz in my pocket as he sent them to me immediately. Within minutes, I had almost 100 pictures of this one moment, this reunion, an introduction. More pictures of us together than I'd ever had before. I looked at my father, and for a moment I saw a reflection. I'd been the first to move away from my close-knit family, and it felt like I abandoned a part of myself. My life was split into befores and afters. How I am now and how my family would like to remember me has always been muddled by half-truths. And somewhere in the center of it all was my father's favorite girl. It wasn't and isn't my place to forgive him for what's done. But my father is part of me, and I couldn't turn away from that. I couldn't turn away from him. I didn't want to. We looked at each other, wondering who the other might be, excited to find out. It wasn't going to be easy. It never would have been. There was a new road to pave together, and I wanted to do the work beside him just as I am. Just as I've always been. "Hi, Daddy," I said, and felt the first tear slither down the side of my face. He pulled me in closer. I pressed my cheek against his chest. I breathed in for 4 seconds, held it for 7, and let it out in 8. This was my father, and I was his daughter. That was a good place to start. Behind us, my aunt cried, "God is so good." Acknowledgements. It would be impossible to thank every single person who helped me find myself in this moment, but I'll consider this a good start. Bryn Clark, my editor, has made a grievous mistake in striking the perfect balance between encouraging and challenging, and now she'll never get rid of me. Thank you for your patience and your brilliant contributions. Thank you to my editorial, marketing, and publicity teams at Flatiron Books and an Oprah book. Thanks, Oprah! This was my publishing debut, and you all set a bar few even attempt to reach. And huge thanks to my amazing agent, Maria Massey, who knew I was worthy of a fantastic first book experience and did everything in her power to make sure that's exactly what I got. Thank you to Hedgebrook for the writing residency that provided me with the literal space to finish my first draft of this book. Thank you to my mother and father for loving me the best way you know how and continuing to grow. Your faith in me gives me more faith in myself. To my siblings and nibblings, still the best people I know in the whole world, thank you. I don't know how I got lucky enough to be this closely related to you, but I'm honored and grateful. I'm always on your side. Thank you to Billy, my grandmother, and all the stories she left me to tell for myself. Thank you to my Muncie family, Mitch, Becky, Charlie, and Wilson. Thank you to the friends and loved ones who have walked beside me, Ashley Henderson, Spencer McNelly, Charlotte Yearwood, Danielle Doherty, Daniel Jose Older, Eric Butler, Trent McFalls, Sulaika Jouard, Jill Chrisman, Kathy Day, Angel Nafis, Shira Ehrlichman, Rachel Syme, Diana Sinat, Zadie Smith, Stevie Wagner, Tyson Mollison, and Brett Tubbs. And of course, Roxane Gay, my friend, mentor, and the shiniest star. Thank you, my friend, for clearing a path. Aminatou Sow, Glennon Doyle, Saeed Jones, Isaac Fitzgerald, Lori Hulse Anderson, and John Green, thank you for sharing kind words about this book. My story, before it goes out into the world, you've made me